Both the January 6th hearings and the rightward lurch of the Supreme Court and seminal rulings on the fundamental questions of religious freedom for all are receiving plenty of real-time coverage this month. But what's the impact of this likely to be come November, if any? The perfect person to ask is political management expert Greg LaBelle, who joins us now. Greg, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks, Jax. Good to see you.
So the Select Committee surprised everyone with a planned extension into July for hearings that were supposed to wrap up this month. From a political impact perspective, does that move dilute public attention, or could it galvanize concern even more?
What it may do, actually, is people, the big question, of course, is, well, why are they delaying it? And I think that if the, and it seems to me that, among other things, they have unearthed some video footage of someone who was doing a long-term series of interviews with the Trump campaign during the election. And they have since gotten hold of that material. And I think a part of this is they're finding what may be described, I don't know, we'll see, as a treasure trove of information inside comments by people prior to January 6th and the election itself that may shed some light on how this all played out and who was doing what and who was saying what. So I suspect that has the potential, I think, to raise the stakes and the interest level. But if it fails to do that, then I think it heads in the other direction. You remember when Mueller was testifying before the Senate on his report on the activities in the 2016 election, the nature of that was so lackluster that it, in fact, worked, I think, in the opposite direction that I think Democratic members of the committee had hoped. So it remains to be seen, but I think it's interesting and potentially helpful to the committee because it seems that they have unearthed some additional information.
So what are some of these new things that you've heard about?
Well, I think that's the big one. I think the other question is, and what I hear some rumors about is that some other folks who had declined to testify, having seen how this is going, have decided I will put my own sort of interpretation on why. And I would say it might be a desire to be on the right side of history. It also might be the desire to sell a forthcoming book or any number of other options. That a few folks, and I don't have any names, I think there's a long list of folks who have declined to speak, are rethinking that and may be interested in having a conversation with the committee.
So, Greg, 50 years ago was the break-in at the Democratic National Committee offices at the Watergate. And
yes,
I'm old
right.
enough to remember the events and the hearings that followed.
Yeah.
You've studied those hearings. You're much younger than I am, so you probably don't remember them firsthand. But all of the nostalgia for those hearings has sort of primed the pump of people watching the January 6th hearings now. What are some of the feelings you've had while watching this testimony? Was there anything that was particularly affecting?
Well, first of all, you're too kind. I was more than old enough at the time. I actually spent later that year, 1972, working on Senator George McGovern's presidential campaign. So I was not a toddler. I remember being glued to the TV, black and white at the time, sitting there watching these things and watching Sam Ervin charm America with his chairmanship of the committee. I have been thinking about that a little bit. And I think one thing that occurs to me, and this relates to, I think, how this committee has sort of played out thus far in terms of its membership. There were Republicans on that committee who were very much in I think, President Nixon's camp as the thing was going on. However, if you look back, they were willing to participate. They participated at a level that was, by today's standards, remarkably honest and sincere. They were asking hard questions. It was dignified, and it proceeded apace. And the committee led to, with the help of one John Dean and his revelations, to get to the bottom of the situation and to move not only members of Congress, but I think the American people along with them. That's very different from what we're seeing now. I think that there's been a little bit of culture shock for me in watching these hearings, because for one thing, we haven't seen Jim Jordan sitting there waving his arms in the air and yelling at people. On a related matter, I think we have spent much more time, which was, I think, also true in my memory of the Watergate hearings, hearing from the witnesses. Hearings now tend to be pontifications by members of committees, accented by a few moments of yes, sir, and no, sir, from witnesses. That has not been the case. This was a huge mistake on the part of Kevin McCarthy, a huge strategic mistake on the part of Kevin McCarthy playing this out.
Do you have the sense that Americans are engaged with these hearings, especially Americans who may not have taken the events of January 6th seriously? Are minds made up?
Some minds are made up. I think it's clear that there are two audiences for the committee. One is the Justice Department and the Attorney General in particular. But the other is that vast middle. These folks who have not been particularly plugged in, who may be hearing about this, maybe watching some of it, but maybe hearing about it secondhand, reading about it online in the paper in the morning and so on and so forth. That's why I think the nature of the hearings has been so critical. We can only hope, Jack, that people are paying attention to this, because there's a lot of devastating information coming out, and it's coming out of the mouths of Republicans. And that, I think, is another significant piece of this. These are members of the administration. These are members of the Trump campaign who have decided, for some of the reasons we may have mentioned earlier, to sort of fess up at this point and give us an honest sense of sort of what was going on and where they were and what they were doing in the process. I don't think we'll really know until we get to the end of the hearings how much of an impact it will have, because it depends, as I said, with the Mueller investigation is a good example, is where these things go and how well they're presented. Thus far, I think they've been presented quite well.
And I think if we can use the word production value here, the term production value, that these hearings are different than any I've ever seen before.
They are, Jack, and I think on two levels. The production values are very high, but they're not glitzy. Right. They manage to hit that middle between, home movies and political ads, which is really important. It's been hardcore, important stuff that's been presented in a straightforward manner, and they've done a really good job of putting this together in a way that it is about news and not about propaganda.
And how are these hearings going to impact the midterm vote this fall? Who's going to be impacted and how?
Again, I think that remains to be seen. We never know. Of course, the unknown factor, as always, is Donald Trump and how he's going to react to this stuff as it goes on. He's already, I understand, complained that his opinion hasn't been asked in these hearings. Personally, I'd love to see that. I'd love to see the committee call him in and have him go in. I don't think it's going to happen. But how he perceives this and how he talks about it has the potential, I think, to split Republican voters, because as you noted, there are people in the Republican Party, the so-called base, who are committed to Donald Trump no matter what. But there are a lot of other thinking, sentient Republicans and independents, I think, who are looking around. Now, the challenge, of course, is how much this affects the really powerful challenges that the Democratic Party is facing on its side, particularly with the issue of inflation. We all know that tends to drive these midterms. So there's going to be a balancing act here between how important these become, these issues become, which are more philosophical as opposed to how much I'm paying for a gallon of gas at the gas station these days. I guess if I were going to put my money on it, I would say probably the gas price is going to win, but we'll see.
So we focused on Congress, and we've alluded to the executive branch. Let's turn to the Supreme Court. The kinds of decisions the court is ending its term with should surprise no one, but they do fundamentally change the kind of country we're living in for many, many Americans. We're talking on a Thursday, and there are still rulings to come tomorrow, Friday. But I think it's safe to assume that a death blow to Roe versus Wade will have happened between when we tape this conversation and when people hear it over the weekend and beyond. So I'd like to call on our electoral expert here to consider what impact these late-term rulings might have at the ballot box in November.
We have to talk about the abortion issue. It is the big one, which I think has the potential to both at its impact, specific impact and its broader impact. I think no decision will probably be more of a clear indicator of where we are going as a country through the eyes of the Supreme Court majority at this point. So I think that decision, and that you're right, we're taping this on Thursday, that decision could possibly come down today, but more than likely by the end of the week. Here's my theory. We hear rumblings about this now that the Chief Justice is trying to sway one of the members who signed on to that draft that was released to move away from it. There's a certain amount of cynicism in me when I watch these things, and I would not be shocked if the final decision is different from the draconian decision that was released in draft form, in that it will attempt to soften the blow, change the perception a little bit. It will not be as hardcore as the language that we saw in that draft. I call this the kid talking to his parents. Can I have a pony? No. Can I have a pony? No. Can I have a pony? No. Well, can I have a dog? Yes. And the dog is the only thing he ever wanted. And I think there's sort of a little bit of this going on here. If they can come up with a decision, and if he can move at least one of the signatories on that draft to a decision that can be presented as not withdrawing Roe v. Wade entirely, if leaving some sort of language in that allows for some sort of fudge, that I think is what Roberts would like to do. What remains to be seen, but that wouldn't shock me if that's how this decision comes down and allows it to be perceived as less critical, less important as we approach the midterms than it seems if you just go on the language that's in the draft. Does that make any sense?
It made a lot of sense. And actually, if they don't get the pony, if they only get the dog, even though it may be what they only really wanted, will that result in a reward for Mitch McConnell and his minions? Or do you think that voters will focus on the less than MAGA imperfections that have, if we can call it, plagued some of the Republicans in Congress?
I think there's such a split in the Republican Party right now, and I think it's growing. We're seeing this over this gun control legislation. I mean, from my perspective, I'm glad we're doing something on gun control, but boy, this compromise is nowhere near what I personally think needs to happen. I have trouble even calling it a gun control legislation. There are some changes, and I know that Chris Murphy and others are happy, and I think appropriately, to have something happen after 30 years, but it's not much. This is splitting their Republicans in Congress. This will certainly, I think, spill over into Republican voters. Some of who will say this is enough, and others will say no, this is not nearly enough. None of this should be allowed. There are splits developing in the Republican Party, and I think that Trump, in his own weird sort of way, almost gets a kick out of these splits that are developing. So all of this is going to take time to sort of sort out. There's so many things that are going on with us right now. We haven't even talked about the issue of Ukraine and how that's affecting so many aspects of our life, and that broader issue of the assaults on democracy across the world, which are important but tend not to have a significant impact on midterm elections, but may to some extent because Ukraine is so pervasive and so much in the news.
Hmm. So looking at the court, are we looking at a new level of politicization, or does it just feel that way? Did earlier generations of conservatives have the same kind of discomfort at some of the seminal rulings of the court on civil rights and marriage equality and stuff like that?
I'm going to take a little bit of a different angle on that, Beck. I don't know whether we can call it politicization on the court. We can definitely call it the politicization of placement on the court. The way in which members of the judiciary end up sitting on the Supreme Court has changed dramatically in the past generation. And I think that's the result. We know a number of these people who signed that draft opinion on abortion said clearly during their hearings, this is settled law. Well, clearly they didn't believe that this was settled law, and they were willing to misrepresent their views then. So I think the process has become much more adversarial on the part of members of the Senate on both sides. It's a bit of a circus now. So I think the problem may be more in the process one goes through to get on the court than once you're on the court. That seems to be, I think, what's causing a lot of these problems and the result that we see that doesn't line up with what we were told during hearings.
Let me ask you to give us a quick take on how you think the Biden administration in general is handling the economic and political challenges that keep coming its way.
As you know, so many of these economic issues are mostly out of control of the administration, or in some cases entirely out of control of the administration. This proposed holiday on federal gas taxes, that's not something that the president can do unilaterally. That has to go through Congress. And many of these things are cyclical. And so it's a difficult place to be in terms of how much the administration can actually do. That said, I continue to be concerned about the messaging strategy coming out of the White House. I'm not sure they're not playing their A game when it comes to messaging, but that has been a problem with Democrats for a very long time. We just saw after this announcement on gas taxes that there were people in the administration who were saying, we don't think this is such a great idea, we don't think it's going to work. That's not good messaging for an administration. So no. That's a part of the problem here.
Greg, what else should we be watching, because you're watching, when it comes to thinking about the midterms?
I think that one of the things we have to pay attention to is Republicans learned from Democrats in the last midterm that women could play a key role. I hear rumblings that Republicans are relying more and more, and this is relatively new for Republicans, relying more and more on reaching out to conservative women in some of these races this time. That's something relatively new for Republicans. That's not usually a specific focus of their work. But the question is how successful that will be in the face of some of these things, like some of the scandal stuff we're seeing coming out of the hearings, but also the abortion decision and others that may be coming down the line. The other thing to watch, I think, and this is more long term, this abortion issue is not the end of the line. Others are in line behind this. If the MAGA base is successful in this, there's every indication that they will go after issues around contraception. They will go after LGBTQ rights. I mean, they want to undo a lot of the stuff that they find absolutely heinous. Just read that platform that came out of the Texas Republican Party this past week. It's unbelievable. It's horrendous what's in there. They want to roll back the clock many, many, many years, and they may not succeed, but they're going to try.
Wow. Worth paying attention to. Well, Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor Emeritus of Political Management at George Washington University and Director Emeritus of GW's Native American Political Leadership Program and Semester in Washington Politics Program. I can only imagine the size of your business card. And just like your host, he doesn't seem to be able to get this retirement thing quite right, because he's now the interim director of the AT&T Center for Indigenous Politics and Policy. That's a lot, and we're glad you could make some time for us on a busy day. Greg has also worked in several presidential campaigns and actually was, for a time at least, the executive director of Interfaith Alliance, just like me. We're trying to have somebody who had that position on the show every week if we can. Greg, thank you for taking the time for us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Jack. It's good to see you, and happy retirement.
Thank you.